few moments could be more moving to a church historian than to have the honor of introducing Roland Bainton, who is giving the Julius Brown Gay Lectures on the very day Martin Luther posted the 95 Theses on the church door at Wittenberg. Dr. Bainton will not be lecturing on Luther, but his connection with Luther, his great book, Here I Stand, makes all of us especially anticipate this event. Dr. Bainton is a native of England. He came with his family to Washington State in 1902. He was educated at Whitman College, a Congregationalist college, at Yale Divinity School, where he received both the BD and the PhD, studying there under Williston Walker. Those of you who have read Williston Walker and Roland Bainton's writings in church history will be somewhat surprised, perhaps, that Walker was his great mentor. But Dr. Bainton is one of the greatest teachers of church history, I think, that America has produced. Not only in the classroom, but through his writings, he has had a gift for helping us really to become a part of the history we are reading about and which we see visually through the illustrations, many of which he himself has prepared. He is the author of more than 30 volumes, some of the best known of which are a little volume called The Church of Our Fathers, Here I Stand, His Life of Martin Luther, The Travail of Religious Liberty, The Reformation of the 16th Century, Hunted Heretic, A Study of Michael Servetus, Christian Attitudes Toward War and Peace, The Horizon History of Christianity, Christendom, Erasmus of Christendom, and recently a three-volume study of women in the Reformation. One is particularly impressed on meeting Dr. Bainton, as I had the privilege yesterday, at the kind of humility which surrounds him, at the kind of personal concern, magnetism, that is present in him. I know from friends who have studied with Dr. Bainton that he continues to keep contact with students. He himself always is looking for those opportunities in which he can serve, enrich the lives of others. And we count it a great privilege, Dr. Bainton, to have you come to give our lectures at this time. And we look forward with anticipation to the kind of insights that you will bring.
Thank you very much. I've taken as my topic today, Jesus or Hamlet. Now, this is not a comparison between the attitude toward life of Jesus and Hamlet. The only question involved is existence. We don't care whether Hamlet was an historical person. He represents a certain attitude toward life. Does it matter to us whether or no Jesus really existed? Well, now some would say that's a silly question. After all, we divide our chronology before Christ and after Christ, and can it be that we do that about somebody who never was? But we've got to recognize the fact that by some his existence has been denied. Well, how did that come about? I think it started when the apple fell on the head of Newton. Because this convinced him of the law of gravity. He believed an immutable law, an unchangeable law. If that then were so, Jesus could not walk on water without going to the bottom. Then came the extension of the idea of an unalterable natural law to all of the phenomena of the physical world.
The conclusion being that any event recorded in the past, which cannot be repeated and critically tested in the present, is to be rejected. Therefore, all of the miracles go. To this, the Christians replied, "The stories of the miracles are the misunderstandings of natural events." This was the rationalistic explanation. Take the walking on the water. Jesus was just waiting on the edge. And Peter, hearing his voice, jumped out of the boat, and the waves so buffeted him that he would have been submerged if Jesus hadn't reached out a hand and pulled him to shore. There's one further little detail. Jesus was walking near the shore in a haze. Whenever they got into trouble, they brought the haze in. Then take the miracle of the loaves. There were several explanations of this. One was that Jesus belonged to a sect of the Essenes who, in a cave on a mountain, had a big storehouse of loaves. And when the crowd assembled, Jesus stood at the mouth of this cave, and his confederates handed out the bread, and he passed it out, and everybody got fed and 12 baskets left over. But some said, "Oh, no, that's a bit too crude." No, what happened was that the little boy with the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes gave them to Jesus, and Jesus had the whole crowd sit down, and he took that bread and broke it up and gave parts of it to the disciples, and about half the crowd had brought their lunch, and they all did the same thing, and everybody got filled and 12 baskets. 12 baskets left over. And then the resurrection. Jesus never died. Well, he did eventually, I mean, but not at that time. Not as a result of the crucifixion. No, the explanation was that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus went to Pilate and offered to bribe him to let them take down the body of Jesus while he was still alive. And Pilate, who had never wanted the crucifixion, agreed without any bribe and gave them free permission and was rewarded by a sweet kiss from his wife. Then they took down the body and placed it in the tomb, along with aromatic spices, which brought him to after a while, though some thought maybe the earthquake did it. And then he got up and took off his grave clothes and came out naked and ran into the gardener, who gave him something to put on. And that's why Mary Magdalene thought he must be the gardener. And then he withdrew up to Galilee and stayed there until he thought about the time had come to die. So then with his friends he went back to the Mount of Olives and was enveloped in a haze. And when the haze lifted, he wasn't there. Then came Strauss. He said, "You know, these explanations are more miraculous than the miracles." No, he said, "What we're dealing with is mythology." Well, now, what is a myth? A myth is an idea which is rendered concrete by expressing it in terms of an episode, a story. Now, take the walking on the water. What is the central idea? The central idea is triumph over darkness and death. It's a myth of the resurrection. And it's given the form of the ability to walk on water and to command the wind and the waves. All right, the miracle of the loaves, what's the myth? What's the idea in the myth? The idea is that Jesus is the bread of life. And that's said in John's Gospel. Now, this is made concrete by the multiplying of loaves. Because he is the bread of life, of which if one eat, he shall never more hunger, as he is the water of life, if which one drinks, one will never more thirst. it is explained in the terms of this kind of an episode. But Strauss said there are also other elements involved. One is to link Jesus with the past and the future. The multiplying of loaves with Elijah was barley loaves. And in John's gospel, Jesus multiplies barley loaves. It's connecting him back with the Old Testament. What the old prophet did, Jesus does. And it links him to the church because the multiplying of the loaves in many details is an anticipation of the love feast with the early Christian community. They sit in groups. Jesus takes the bread. He blesses it. He distributes it to the disciples, the deacons in the early church, who pass it out to the group. And it is noteworthy that Mark has the story twice, and in the second time, there are not 12 baskets, there are 7, as there were 7 deacons in the early church. And what do they do with the extra baskets? Take it to those who weren't able to be present. So you've got, according to Strauss, the central idea, the Christ is the bread of life, a linking with the old dispensation and a foretaste of that which was yet to come. Well, then you come to the more difficult question of the resurrection. And I can't take time to go into all the details of the historical material, other than to point out that there is a distinction between a resurrection of the body and a resurrection of the spirit. And it is noteworthy that Paul never refers to the resurrection of the body as such. It's always the resurrection of the spirit. I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. It's the living presence of Christ in the Christian community. And it's rather interesting that centuries later, Athanasius, defending the resurrection, never appealed to the evidence of the Gospels. He said, "Is he a dead Christ who is making the adulterer chaste, the murderer gentle, the vindictive kindly? Is he a dead Christ who is working such miracles in the lives of believers?" And this is the testimony of all the ages. I read a story of what happened when the Japanese had overrun East Asia, and Christians were being persecuted. There was a case of one man, a Christian, who had been beaten up and was in dire need of medical attention. The missionary there was afraid to ask anybody to go, any doctor, and look after him, because that would implicate the doctor. He simply went to his own Chinese doctor and told him the story, didn't ask him to do anything. And the doctor said at once, "I go." He said, "Why did you go?" "Jesus sent me." So on the resurrection, one has the question of the physical connected with the empty tomb and the appearances, which may have been spiritual in character, and the testimony to that is successive through all the ages. Well, now it would take too long to go into all of the historical details, but there is the recognition here of the possibility that the body had been removed, but there was nevertheless a resurrection and an appearance. In other words, in all of these three instances, there is the possibility that the actual historical experience described is a concretion of a true idea. Well, the next stage was to say, all right, you admit there's some myth. Why not all of it a myth? And Jesus never was at all. He's just an idea. And the story we have is the concretion of the idea of a sinless man. Now, this was taken up by Kautsky, who said, well, what's the central idea? He said, revolution. Blessed are the poor. I came not to bring peace, but a sword. And the Christianity was a myth created by a turbulent proletariat in the Roman Empire? One reply to that was, we have no evidence of any such a turbulent mob, and after all, it didn't originate in the Roman Empire, but in Palestine. That's an historical reply to that. But then came Kalkoff. No, he said it's not revolution. It's rather the idea of the spirit that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. It's the myth of the universal incarnation of God in man. So both of them are denying that Jesus ever existed at all, and are saying that one group or another created the whole story. Then came the reply, and the reply was that people who make myths don't put into the myths what they don't believe or what they find difficult to believe. And in the Gospels, there are recordings of sayings or events with regard to Jesus which bothered the evangelists. For example, why callest thou me good? None is good but God. That might be taken to mean I'm not good and I'm not God. But the early church believed that he was. They wouldn't have put that saying in if they had made it up. And again, there is none greater born of woman than John the Baptist. They never would have made that up, because there was a rival sect of the Baptists. You remember that Prisca and Aquila had only the baptism of John, and they had to have also the baptism of Jesus. So they never would have made up that kind of a praise of John the Baptist if it hadn't been said. They might have added, nevertheless, the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he, to take the edge off it, but never the first part of it. That is definitely difficult for them. Another very difficult point was the baptism of Jesus for the remission of sins. They believed he didn't have any sins. Then why was he baptized? John's gospel leaves out the baptism. You have John the Baptist, who predicts that a greater is coming, and I saw a dove, but not the baptism. In Matthew's gospel, John protests and says, you ought to be baptizing me. And Jesus said, do it to fulfill all righteousness. It's evidently something that bothers them, the baptism of Jesus for the remission of sins. But it's there because they're honest and they're putting down something that was. Well, there are a good many points of this kind. And of course, the fact that one disciple denied him, that another betrayed him, and the crucifixion itself was a stumbling block to the Jewish and the Gentile world. And all of these are faithfully recorded. Now, that still leaves open the possibility that certain episodes may be the concretion of ideas, but at least you've got a very solid nucleus of fact. But then came a conclusion on the part of many theologians who said, well, anyhow, this is a question of history. And theology can't be tied up with history. It's uncertain. We'll just have to leave it to the historians. And if they come to the conclusion that Jesus never existed, it won't matter anyway, because we have the ideal, and that's really enough. Just the idea. That'll be enough. There were quite a few who said that around 1900. Tillich spoke rather differently at the end of his career, but in the 30s he said, Christ is the center of history even if Jesus never existed. I think he meant that the idea of Christ is central to the entire integrity of Western culture, even if it was only an idea. So one, by this process, eliminates the incarnation. It's practically saying it doesn't matter whether or no the Word became flesh. It's only the idea. So that brings us to the question, how much does it matter? Of course, it also is tied up with the question, how much do we know? And there are some who say, yes, Jesus existed. We know some things about him. We don't know a great deal. So really what we do is to proclaim what the early disciples proclaimed about him. It's still saying that his actual existence isn't so important. It's the kerygma, that's the word they use. It's the proclamation. That is Christianity. But we can't tell whether he was sinless. We can't prove it. Well, I think it's true. We cannot penetrate the inner consciousness of Jesus. We can't say with absolute assurance that there was nothing in his life that he ever regretted. We don't know that much. We know this, that those who lived with him, walked with him, talked with him, said, tempted in all things, even as we are, yet without sin. Where else does one find a figure of such commanding excellence that those who lived in such intimacy discovered in him no blemish? Then take the testimony of a Jewish scholar, Fermes by name, on Jesus the Jew. He said Jesus was, in many respects, a Pharisee. There were two branches of the Pharisees, the strict and the more liberal. He belonged to the more liberal group. The Sabbath is not made from man is not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath is not made for man. The whole question of Sabbatarianism and whether it was legitimate to eat an egg that had been laid on the Sabbath and all that kind of thing. The liberal Pharisees would quite agree with Jesus on that point. But there was this difference between Jesus and the Pharisees. They were the separated ones. That's what the word means. They were the holy ones. They withdrew themselves from the masses. The prophets had called for justice to the poor and the outcast. Jesus identified himself with the outcast and the poor. He was greater, said this Jewish scholar, than all the prophets, because he emptied himself and became one with the outcasts. Sometimes Jesus is compared with Socrates, who was also a martyr, but not this kind of a martyr. Where in all antiquity do we find the leader of a group who, with a towel over his arm and a basin of water at his feet, knelt down and did the work of a slave, washing the grime off the feet of peasants? Where do we find one? Not one who quietly drinks the hemlock, but agonizing on the cross and saying, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Luther rightly said, it passes all comprehension. And the one who did this was a man. The church never denied the humanity of Jesus. What does this say to us about the potentiality of humanity? He was a man. He was in the flesh. And yet, He has become as man a pioneer, our pioneer. The new translation of the beginning of the 12th chapter of the Epistle to the Hebrews, I think, is very sound. It calls him the author and pioneer of our salvation, archegos, the pioneer. The pioneer is one who does something first which others can do afterwards. Columbus was the first to open up the new world to the old. Millions have done it since. Lindbergh was the first to fly across the ocean. Millions have done it since. Jesus was the first to show us such astounding capacity of nobility in man. And we, because he has done it, can do it too. And then what does it say to us about God? There are some who say we've got to begin with revelation and come down to man. But how shall we begin with God whom we have not seen to understand man whom we have seen? Do we not have to begin with man whom we have seen and reach out to God whom we have not seen? And is not this excellence of one in the flesh a pointer to God? There is a story of which I am fond by Harriet Beecher Stowe. It is the story of a lad in his teens who had been drowned at sea. The belief was that if one had not had a convulsive conversion experience and died, one was irretrievably lost. The mother of this lad was utterly shattered. And the black mammy, Candice, took her on her lap and said, "Honey, honey, you knows I love you. Poor old Candice, I love you. And am I better than him that made me? Look at Jesus. See the blood streaming down his face. He loves your Jimmy. He will not let him perish. Am I better than him that made me? Can we not rise from such excellence in the flesh to God the Creator? From the nobility that we find in flesh and blood, so that we can say, he that hath seen me hath seen the Father." Christianity is greatly weakened if it's only an idea. It's more than idea. It is and became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have beheld his glory as of the only begotten of the Father.